Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, in thinking about the topic of today's show, which I'll introduce to you in a second, it occurs to me that we seem to have an interest in archaeology, and it's an archaeologically oriented show for sure. And in particular, it turns out the discovery of human remains, both modern and prehistoric, like we had a group on, of people who are searching for the remains of downed World War II air crews in the South Pacific. And in the past, we've had a forensic archaeologist on who was talking with us about the latest high-tech tools for finding buried murder victims. They're not ancient, but they're still buried and need archaeological tools to find them. And we've had an historian, an archaeologist on, talking about the Native American cemetery site at Wendover Farms here in East Central Florida. That was interesting stuff. And then, you know, we even had a group on who are searching for Amelia Earhart's crash site and think that they've found her remains. So it just suddenly struck me that, you know, I have this macabre fascination. Actually, I don't. It's a coincidence over a period of 6 years here, but I must be interested in archaeology anyway. My guest today is Aaron Dieter Wolf, who is a prehistoric archaeologist for the state of Tennessee in the state's Division of Archaeology. Welcome, Aaron.
Hey, Court. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you on. Aaron is also an adjunct professor of archaeology at Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. So the story that caught my eye in national news is that recently in a backyard in, I guess, in Franklin, Tennessee, which I think is a suburb of Nashville, scientists have unearthed the bones of what they think are, and I think they're pretty sure, are the bones of a mastodon, along with some stone tools that indicate the presence of ancient hunters there. And so it looks like it's maybe the site where some prehistoric Native American hunters tracked down and killed a mastodon and maybe slaughtered him there. And so it's an archaeological site in somebody's backyard, and that's an interesting story in itself, how that was found. But Aaron, why don't you go ahead and just kind of give us the broad outlines of that story and tell us what's going on there.
Absolutely, Court. Well, the site is called the Coates Hines site, and it was first identified in 1977 when a company that owns a golf course in Franklin, Tennessee was doing some landscaping. And while working along a small stream drainage on their course, they noticed some large, what they presume were animal bones, eroding out of the stream drainage. And they contacted our office at the Tennessee Division of Archaeology, and some archaeologists from our office went out there and did some salvage work prior to the golf course moving any more dirt. And what they found in that location was the partial skeleton of an adult female mastodon. And those finds were never published. The area was subsequently destroyed by earth moving by the golf course. And that area was actually not originally identified as an archaeological site because at the time there was no evidence of human activity taking place there. It was just the partially fossilized skeleton of a mastodon. What makes it archaeology is actually having that connection with humans, with people actually doing something or interacting with or hunting those animals. So subsequently, in 1994, the land adjacent to the golf course was being developed into a subdivision. And at that time, staff from the Division of Archaeology were doing an inspection of that same stream drainage about 65 feet from the original mastodon find. And they noticed a tusk eroding out from the bottom of this stream drainage. And the developer allowed an excavation to be conducted along the stream bank. And in the 1994 excavations, they uncovered a small bone bed that consisted of most of a young male mastodon, as well as pieces of Ice Age horse and muskrat and deer and canid and some turtle as well.
So the plot thickened. How old do they think this site is? Is it one site, or is it kind of a multi-layer thing?
It is. We presume a multi-layered site. What we think is going on, based on the soils that are surrounding these bones, is that at the end of the last ice age, about 11,000 or 12,000 years before present, this stream drainage had been backed up, maybe blocked by tree falls or possibly by a beaver dam, and so it formed this shallow ice age pond. And that the species that were living in the area at the time were being drawn to this pond as a watering hole. Now, what was important about the second mastodon find in 1994 is that while they were excavating it, they found fragments of stone tools mixed in among the mastodon bones. Hmm. And when they took the bones themselves back to the lab and looked at them under a microscope, they were actually able to identify cut marks on the thoracic vertebra from that mastodon, which is where people were using stone tools to butcher the animal, to remove the dorsal muscles along the backbone. And that's what makes it an archaeological site.
Yeah, so it is, like I said in the introduction, that people were butchering the animal there. Is it very unusual, at least in North America, to find prehistoric sites where you can clearly see the connection between people who were on the ground at the same time that the animal was?
Absolutely. That's what really makes this site special, is the connection with people. There are lots of finds of Ice Age fauna throughout the United States and throughout North and South America, but there's really only a handful of sites where you have direct evidence of people actually having interacted with or hunted these animals. This side of the Mississippi River, we have only, I think, three or four of these sites at this point, one of which is the Coates Hines site, which we were just working on, another of which is the Paige Ladson site in Florida.
There was a homeowner named Paul Litchie who, I guess, attended a meeting. He himself is a university professor, so, you know, an educated man and a person of some interest in knowledge. And he recognized that what was being described about this site was his own property. And so I think, you know, how did that happen, that he came forward and agreed to let you excavate it? Was that something that was a barrier before and it became suddenly an open door, or how did that work?
Well, Paul had sat in on a construction law class, I believe it was, at Vanderbilt. And in that class, the former state archaeologist was giving a presentation on Tennessee archaeology and prehistory, and he described the mastodon site at Coates Hines. And based on that description, Paul was able to identify that he really thought this was in his backyard. And so he contacted our office to get more information. And we had actually been continuing to inspect that stream drainage over the last 10 or 15 years. And had been continuing to find bones as they were washing out and eroding out of that bank line. But there hadn't been any urge or any impetus to conduct further excavation, since it was now, in fact, protected under someone's backyard. We knew that the homeowners had not moved to build a swimming pool on it or anything like this, and so it was actually stable, which for an archaeological site is a great thing. You know, if you can get a site that has been capped off, that's not going to have any further impacts from development or construction, then that's a safe site. And you tend to then turn your attention somewhere else to sites that are more endangered. So Paul had contacted us and expressed interest in the site and encouraged us to conduct some additional excavations. And so on his behalf, we applied to the Tennessee Historical Commission for one of their historic preservation grants. And we were awarded that grant last year. These grants are given to identify and examine sites that are important to Tennessee prehistory or to Tennessee history as a whole. And what we were going to do with this grant was go in and see how much of the site was left, if anything was left. There had been limited excavations in 1977 and in 1994, but those holes were pretty small that were dug back then. And so we had no idea how much bigger the site was. You know, maybe everything had been excavated from it and there was nothing left. Maybe there was a lot more to be found. So we wanted to see what was still left and if anything was left in the ground, to use that information to nominate the site for inclusion in the National Register of Historic Places. That list is maintained by the National Park Service and is a list of America's historic treasures, basically, of places that are worth identifying and preserving.
Yeah, okay. That's interesting that one homeowner's property, I mean, were you pretty confident that the entire site would be on that one person's property, or could it have extended onto neighboring properties? I don't know if we're talking about a half-acre lot or 10 acres here.
It's a fairly small lot. It's in a residential subdivision. We did not know at the time whether it extended into other parts of the property. In fact, we still don't know that for 100% certain. There may still be pieces of this site left underneath the golf course or left underneath two adjacent home lots in that same subdivision. We've only had the opportunity to open this one trench into Paul's backyard. Mm-hmm. And that in itself was a fairly major undertaking. We're talking about a site that's 14 feet below modern ground surface.
Wow.
And so just getting down there is just sort of a dog and pony show to open a hole that's that big and that deep and still do it in a way that lets you have more than just a glimpse at what's at the bottom of it.
Yeah, so the average person would not be all that open to digging a giant trench through their backyard. But
it would be a very deep, very narrow hole. Yeah, we actually we use backhoe equipment to open a stepped trench that went down that 14 feet to the top of the levels of the Ice Age pond, where we could see that 12,000, 13,000-year-old clay showing up. And from that point down, then, we did hand excavations through the clay to find the bottom of the pond and the bone bed itself. The final window that we ended up getting into the site was about 5 feet wide by about 40 or 50 feet long.
Wow.
But that's still a relatively small view into what could be a very large pond.
Sure, it's just a slice across it. So to really excavate the entire site, you'd have to strip it all down 14 feet deep across a pretty large area. So that would be...
Yeah, you'd end up with something that looked like an empty Olympic swimming pool, I think, before it was over.
Yeah, or a sinkhole here in Florida.
Yeah.
The Wendover Farm site that I mentioned earlier also relied on the generosity of the owner. That was a pretty large site, and it was about to undergo development into a housing development. Anyway, when it transpired that these were ancient skeletons that were preserved in what was a former peat bog, the owner agreed to stop development and let the entire excavation proceed, and that delayed his development by like 2 years. So that was extremely lucky and generous.
Absolutely. Those are really fortuitous situations. And this site has had sort of a cornucopia of that, if you will. The original developers back in 1994 were willing to let the Division of Archaeology do work on that property. They actually rescheduled the order in which they were going to develop the lots to allow them extra time to work. And now, of course, Paul allowing us to come in and dig this massive trench in his backyard has been really, really awesome.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Aaron Dieterwolf, who is a prehistoric archaeologist working for the state of Tennessee in its Division of Archaeology. And we're talking about a site where a mastodon was found, along with the tools and other implements of some hunters who had killed and slaughtered the mastodon there on the site. It's a very unusual kind of archaeological site. Aaron, what are mastodons? I mean, I think we all have an idea that they're some sort of prehistoric elephant, but how do they differ from woolly mammoths, for example? That's something probably most people don't know.
Absolutely. The creature we're actually talking about is an American mastodon, and they lived throughout North America from about 3.74 million years ago up until about 11,000 years ago. They look like a big hairy elephant. They stood about 8 or 10 feet tall at the shoulder. They're about 4 to 6 tons in weight and had tusks that come generally straight out from their face while slightly curving inwards towards the tip that can be very long, can be up to 6 or 7 feet long in some cases.
But they're not the same as a woolly mammoth? That's a different species?
Absolutely. They are the same genus, but they are a different species. The main difference between them comes into the skeleton and what the different critters eat. The mammoth, the woolly mammoth, has a more domed skull. It has tusks that really dramatically curve backwards up towards its face, and it has only upper tusks. It lacks lower tusks. The mastodon has a more sloping skull. It has those tusks that go sort of straight out and curve slightly inward. And we believe that female mastodon actually have very small, almost vestigial lower tusks. The biggest difference between the two of them you can see in their teeth. The teeth of mastodon have these conical protrusions on the top of them. They look a lot more similar to the teeth of, say, deer or giraffe, whereas the mammoth teeth are relatively flat, and that's because mammoths were grazers. They lived primarily in the plains. They ate grasses, so they needed these teeth that are more like cow's teeth for grinding down those grasses. The mastodon were browsers. They lived in sort of a mixed woodland environment and were very much at home here in the eastern United States. And so they had these sort of conical teeth that allowed them to do things like strip bark and leaves from trees.
It sounds like the mastodons maybe were more like modern elephants than the mammoths were. Which, if you stood them all three side by side, which pair would look most alike?
The mastodon and the modern elephant would look the most alike. The woolly mammoth is the creature that we see in a lot of the pop culture references and the Ice Age cartoons. They seem for some reason to be much more photogenic, or at least better suited to children's cartoons.
Okay.
But the mastodon look much more like the modern day elephant, just a little hairier.
So you said that they were all over North America, which is, you know, really surprising. I mean, to think of elephants in North America, and I know they came down to South Florida. I, in fact, have a petrified mastodon tooth that came out of a sand pit in Central Florida, where there are quite a number of them discovered. I mean, it's the size of, if you put both your fists together, it's bigger than that, I would say. So they came all the way down to tropical climates, but what were some other exotic animals that were around at that time? And here we're only talking about, I think, around 12,000 years ago or something. We're not talking a million years ago. I've heard that there were camels around that same time.
Absolutely. There were any number of large Ice Age species, and in archaeology we call them Ice Age megafauna, all of which are now extinct. Things like dire wolf, short-faced bear, giant ground sloth, saber-toothed tiger, the American lion, Ice Age horse. There was actually a horse in North America that went extinct at the end of the last Ice Age, and then horses did not exist in North America until they were reintroduced by the European explorers.
So if these animals, these mega animals, were around at the time that the first Indians were in North America, that I guess came across the Bering Ice Bridge from Siberia 13 or so thousand years ago, if they were around that recently, what caused them to go extinct? Was it the recession of the Ice Age, or were they hunted into extinction? What do they think?
Well, there's been a lot of debate about that. You know, we're not actually 100% sure on when the first people arrived in the Americas. The Bering Land Bridge and the ice-free corridor across Canada has been the traditional explanation. But there's a lot of controversy, actually, about that in the archaeological community, and there have been a number of new ideas floated as to different routes or different time periods that the first Americans may have arrived. The biggest reason for this is that the Bering Land Bridge and the ice-free corridor seem to date to about 12,000 years ago, but we have sites in the eastern United States and down in South America that date to 14,000 years at least. There are people now that have sites that they think go back 20 or 30,000 years before present.
Wow.
And so this actually predates the ice-free corridor.
Hmm.
And so since they would have not had a route through the glaciers that were covering Canada, it's been proposed that, well, they must have had other ways to get here. And so, for example, people have proposed that there may have been a coastal route, traveling in hide and skin boats along the edge of the ice, again from Siberia, but down the west coast of America,
mm-hmm.
and down the west coast of South America. It's been proposed that there may be a Polynesian or Pacific maritime route. And most recently, Dennis Stanford up at the Smithsonian Institution has proposed what he calls the Solutrean Connection, which has people coming from Western Europe along the edges of the ice sheets across the Atlantic, past Greenland, and down into the eastern seaboard.
It's really amazing how little we know. I mean, we know in some respects more about distant galaxies than we know about our own species 12,000 years ago. So, you know, here we have people who were in North America at least 12,000 years ago and longer, who were hunting these things that we think of almost as coming from the dinosaur age. But
that's
so
right.
What do we know about the paleo Indians, if that's what you call them, who probably hunted this mastodon, for example, there in Tennessee?
Well, we know that the paleo Indians were what you would call a hunter-gatherer people. They were not practicing horticulture yet. We have this traditional viewpoint of the paleo Indians as living in the American Southwest and surviving at the end of that last ice age by hunting megafauna, by hunting specifically mastodon and woolly mammoth. But that's sort of an outdated model, and recent research has shown us that the major concentration of paleo-Indian occupation in the United States is actually in the southeastern U.S., and we know this because there's been data models generated using all of the known finds of paleo-Indian artifacts, and when you throw them all out there on a map, they cluster in the southeastern U.S. In fact, they seem to cluster in Middle Tennessee largely.
Hmm.
This is fairly new information. We joke here that we probably have more paleo-Indian artifacts in our office than they do in the entire state of New Mexico. It's just that the first finds of paleo-Indian archaeological sites happened in the Southwest.
Are you talking primarily about arrowheads and potsherds or what?
Arrowheads. These are people who had not yet started to make pottery. That doesn't come around until, oh, probably 5,000 years before present as people start to develop horticulture and agriculture. So the main artifacts that we have from these people are the stone tools that they left behind and the evidence of what they were eating, animal bone.
So you don't have art carved on walls and where you can kind of get some idea of their talents, and you don't have anything showing their own adornments or anything like that. You just basically have some tools and artifacts left behind, right?
Exactly. There are a couple of finds of possible paleo-Indian artifacts. In fact, one of them is from Florida, and one of them is from Texas, where in the case of Florida, I believe they think they have a tusk that has an image of a woolly mammoth carved onto it.
Hmm.
And from the Galt site in Texas, they have maybe several rocks at this point that have patterns incised on them. But it's not like the caves in France that you're thinking of from the Upper Paleolithic. We don't have this literal representation of how they were living or what they were wearing. Or, you know, we have no idea what language they were speaking, for example.
Do we have any idea whether those Indians, I mean, I guess you can make an assumption, but do we have any realistic way of connecting them to modern Native American tribes in the area, particularly in Tennessee?
Well, we know for certain that these are the ancestors of the modern Native American tribes. What's not clear is the exact genetic or cultural relationship. You know, 12,000 years is a lot of time for populations to move around and to shift and for new groups to come in or to leave. So we're not exactly sure which tribe these people are the ancestors of, but they are generally the ancestors of all modern Native Americans.
Just quickly, what are some of the main Native American tribes in Tennessee?
Tennessee, we have the Chickasaw, the Choctaw, the Creek, the Uchi, and the Cherokee all claim land here in Tennessee during the early historic period.
Okay, so what scientific advances do you hope can be made from this site that we're talking about here south of Nashville?
Well, our principal goal for the dig was to gather enough data to show that the site was intact and to nominate it to the National Register. And I think we have more than enough data to do that. We're going to get involved in that process starting in January of actually writing the nomination. But we also collected a lot of data which will inform future research and can be used to look into some big picture research questions about Paleo-Indians. For example, we took pollen samples from above, below, and within the pond sediments. And this is going to help inform us as to the environmental conditions at the end of the last ice age. What species were growing around the pond? How has that changed in the interim? Are these species extinct? Are they things that still show up in other places in Tennessee? We'll find out more information about Paleo-Indian diets. We know these people weren't just eating mastodon to get by. In fact, they were gathering plants and eating a lot of smaller game. It's been proposed that Paleo-Indians subsisted largely on things like turtle rather than on mastodon, which makes a lot of sense when you've got a sharp stick and a rock to have dinner with.
Right.
That you're going to go after turtle instead of after mastodon. But so this is going to teach us more about what they're eating, their hunting practices. For example, we may be able to determine whether they were ambushing these animals as they were coming to the pond for water or whether they were attacking them elsewhere and just catching them then when they died naturally from blood loss at the edge of the pond. Also, patterns of raw material use. Where were they getting the stone for their stone tools? Is it things they were picking up locally or were they carrying it in over great distances?
That's interesting. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with archaeologist Aaron Dieter Wolf, who is a state archaeologist in Tennessee, about a find in the state of Tennessee recently of a mastodon that looks like it had been hunted, killed, and slaughtered by prehistoric Indians there. So, Aaron, what do you do? I mean, you know, we've been talking about what you do in this site, but what's the broad range of what you do as a state archaeologist?
Well, I am not the state archaeologist. He's actually my boss.
Okay.
But I work for the State Division of Archaeology, and our primary job here is managing archaeological sites that are on state-owned lands. We also do conduct excavations and research and publish the results of those studies. The state of Tennessee has large archaeological collections from 200 years of people doing legal and illegal digging, and we manage those collections and curate them. And then we also do investigate disturbances to prehistoric human skeletal remains.
Okay. Like if, you know, there's a development going on and a prehistoric Indian burial site is found, what do you do with it? I mean, do you don't just put it in a box and shove it in a drawer in the archive in the state capitol or something? I mean, do you move the burial site? What do you do?
We actually do not do any burial removals. Under Tennessee state law, prehistoric graves are protected by the same laws that protect modern cemeteries or Civil War cemeteries. Regardless of the age, a cemetery is considered to be a cemetery.
Okay.
There is a provision in Tennessee state law that will let someone terminate a cemetery, is the phrase that's used, if they can show that it has been abandoned or neglected or is no longer in use.
Well, I guess that covers most prehistoric sites then, doesn't it?
That does cover most prehistoric cemeteries. So what that sets up is a process where, in particular, development that's planned in an area that has a prehistoric cemetery or prehistoric burial can go to the Chancery Court and petition the court to terminate the cemetery, in which case then, if the court agrees, the developer can hire an archaeological consulting firm to come in and exhume and then rebury those remains. Under state law, the remains are to be reburied on site, and the court generally likes for it to be as close as possible to the original location.
Well, it sounds complicated, and I hope it doesn't happen often because too many sensibilities get involved.
It happens more often than you would think, actually. Tennessee is loaded with prehistoric archaeological sites. We've got more than 30,000 recorded sites in Tennessee here, and probably 17,000 of those are exclusively prehistoric. And there's a lot of modern development going into things that were formerly farmland, or areas that were undeveloped, and so a lot of sites are getting found the hard way.
To you as an archaeologist, what's the most interesting or kind of grandest archaeological site that you've investigated in Tennessee?
Wow, I've been on all kinds of sites since I've been working here in Tennessee, and they range from 50-year-old farmsteads to mound villages. There's just an incredible variety. I think the Coates Hines site is probably one of the ones that sort of gives me the chills when I think about it. It is about as old as you can get archaeologically in the New World. There's not much that's really older than this in the New World. There are very few sites like this where you have people and extinct Ice Age megafauna interacting with one another. It's really a very important site, and I know it sort of may seem to your listeners like, oh, well, you know, it's just a bunch of bones in the ground. What's exciting about that? But it's sort of the scope of that. You know, this is 12,000 years before present. These are the first Americans, and to get in there and be able to learn more about them and share that with the archaeological community and with the public is really, really exciting.
Well, our audience and all the stations are NPR listeners, and I think they understand the importance and the excitement of finding that, particularly where you've got the very early people in connection right there with the animal and, you know, the marks on the bones that you described from their tools. Well, what else do you study? We just have a minute or so left. I think I saw in your resume and your description online that you're interested in prehistoric tattooing.
I am. That's actually been an ongoing research project of mine for several years now, to look at the tattooing that was practiced by prehistoric people. You know, the first European explorers who show up document that the Native Americans who were living throughout the Southeast at that time were tattooing themselves. But archaeologically, we don't have much of a footprint of that. No one has ever really identified a tattoo needle in an archaeological assemblage. Hmm. And so my research is trying to get at, well, what were these specific tools that they were using to tattoo themselves?
I guess you could publish a book, and people in their teens and 20s would buy it and try to copy some of the designs, right?
But absolutely. We have a book that hopefully will be coming out through University Press of Florida, as a matter of fact.
There you go. I know that your earlier background as a student was in research on Mayan sites in Guatemala and Belize. And so, you know, there you're talking about really grand temples and pyramids and lots of artwork. And these North American sites are a lot sparser and smaller. We just have a minute or so left, Aaron. But in brief, what keeps it interesting to you working there in Tennessee on these sites?
Well, of course, I mean, the important thing to remember is that the scope of prehistory is the same, whether you're in Central America or the southeastern United States, ranging from the first Americans up through these complex societies. And the late prehistoric chiefdoms here in the southeast are just as interesting as, say, the ancient Maya. They have the same kind of complex art and iconography, state religions, social stratification. The main difference is that they used earth and perishable materials instead of stone to build their cities. And so traditionally they've been sort of forgotten about or looked down on. But the civilizations are just as complex and just as interesting here in the Southeast.
Okay, good answer. Well, Aaron Dieter-Wolf, I sure appreciate you being on with us here today on American Variety to talk about prehistoric archaeology and the find you've got in Tennessee. One thing that people can do is Google Tennessee Archaeology Network to find out more about this site and similar sites in Tennessee. I won't give you the URL, it's way too long, but Tennessee Archaeology Network. Thanks again, Aaron, for being on with us on American Variety.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to you all for listening, and I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.